Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading from the December-January 2026 issue of Guideposts magazine and finish reading the story we started last time, Sheltered. Years passed, then came John's death and a brutal winter that banked towering snowdrifts over my young trees. When the snow melted, I was heartbroken to see that the heavy drifts had bent every tree in half, bowing each to the earth. I couldn't even pray, and I couldn't imagine replanting. But in a couple days, I got an idea. I went to town and bought light metal step-in fence posts. Then I cut the legs from John's old jeans into long strips. Because the tree trunks were wounded only on one side, I was able to gently straighten each tree, anchoring it upright by tying the denim strips around its trunk and to the base of the metal fence posts. In time, the young trees healed and continued to grow. Some winters later, a brutal wind came from the south, packing the farmyard with snow and burying my cow tank. In the spring, I surveyed the south side of the yard, wondering at the openness of the terrain that permitted the wind to blast through. No one in the more than 100-year history of the farm had thought to plant trees along the southern boundary. I hand-planted 100 pine seedlings in three rows to one day stop the south wind, but the young pines all died that year except for three. I bought seedlings from another source and replanted the following spring. This time, they took root and grew. I could see the point God was making, telling me that planting prayers is like planting trees. Don't give up hope. Keep praying, even though it seems as if I have not answered. I will always answer in my own time, in my own way. Like trees, prayers can run into difficulties and take a long time to grow. Another winter morning, some days later, this time I slept through the night because I'd made another phone call and God had provided a third technician who found and fixed the problem with the furnace. Now it ran like a pro. But the howl of the wind woke me early and made me worry for my livestock. Then I reminded myself that the trees I'd planted would do their job and provide shelter. Peace to the wind, I prayed, and went back to sleep. Family time. Family ties. It was the craziest gift I'd ever gotten, and possibly one of the best, by Jeannie Hughes, Hurricane, West Virginia. One afternoon, 2 weeks before Christmas, the first guests arrived at our Hurricane West Virginia home for the annual family get-together, stomping their snow-covered boots on my freshly mopped hardwood floors. I put on my holiday game face and nudged my husband Roger and my daughter Lindsay to flash their most welcoming smiles. After all, some of our relatives had driven more than an hour from Charleston for the party. Aunt Frieda sashayed in with the same outrageous pronouncement she made every year. Jesus couldn't be here, so I came in his place. My young cousin Mary Beth rolled her eyes, and Uncle Jane huffed with impatience at the time it took the other dozen family members to wrangle off their boots. Now it begins, I thought, only a few minutes before the barbs start flying. Why do I even bother? Every year I prayed that somehow we'd transform into the Norman Rockwell family I dreamed of since I was a little girl. My late mother's mental illness had made my childhood pretty rough, and I guess I was hoping to bring some joy to this clan any way I could. One-on-one, my relatives were quite lovely, but put them together and even Santa himself would be tearing out his beard. I felt jealous of my brother, who didn't have to show up since he lived far away in New Jersey. Roger hauled our guests' heavy winter coats to the spare bedroom while I set the gift each person had bought under our brightly lit Christmas tree. Each year, we drew names for the relative we would buy a gift for the following year. As folks got settled, I realized there weren't enough seats for everyone in the family room, even with chairs we'd carried in from the dining room and the breakfast nook. The younger ones would have to stand. Lindsay came with me to the kitchen to finish arranging the finger sandwiches, pigs in a blanket, and cream cheese roll-up. Thanks goodness Aunt Mary had brought her famous meatballs. Oh no, were those voices rising in the family room? I rushed back in just as Uncle Sam rumbled, "Not in my church." Hoping to head off an argument, I said loudly, "Why don't we get something to eat?" Everyone stopped talking, surprised at my outburst. I thought someone might demand to know my opinion on whatever religious or political issue they were at odds over. Instead, my relatives stood and filed into the kitchen. They'd loaded up their paper plates. Once everyone started chowing down, I could relax. As long as their mouths were full, insults and snide comments couldn't spill out. We finished eating with a minimum of squabbles. Mary Beth went to the tree and began handing out the presents. When she tossed one in my direction, I knew right away it was from Aunt Frieda. The folded and creased wrapping paper she had saved from the previous year was a dead giveaway. We took turns opening our gifts. As usual, folks weren't pleased with what they'd received. The bickering started up again. "How big do you think I am?" Uncle June asked when he saw his sweater was tagged XL. Aunt Mary said, "I don't need another pie plate. You think I cook for the whole neighborhood?" On and on it went. At least Uncle Stan was happy with the yellow scarf I got him, or faked it well. Then it was my turn. "Be careful with that paper," Aunt Frieda said. "I'd like it back to use next year." I removed the tiny pieces of tape. No waste there either. If I ever drew my aunt's name, I knew what I would buy her: holiday gift bags. I lifted the lid off the box. All I saw was a tangled mess of different fabrics. "What did you get?" Lindsay asked. I pulled the mismatched material from the box. "Oh my goodness," I said, trying to sound pleased. I stood and shook the wrinkles out of the item so I could tell what it was. Dozens of men's ties were sewn over the waistband of a black slip. I guessed it was supposed to be a skirt. Aunt Frieda clapped her hands. "I knew if I kept your Uncle Charles' ties after his death, I'd find the perfect use for them," she said. The ties dangled to my knees in a riot of patterns and colors. Red and blue stripes, orange and green polka dots. I even spotted one with prancing purple horses. I struggled to find the right words. "Wow, it's so unique." "You have to try it on," Aunt Frieda said. Everyone started chanting, "Try it on, try it on." I trudged up the stairs and closed my bedroom door. I slid off my pants and pulled on the skirt. At least it fit, kind of. I knew it would hurt my aunt's feelings if I didn't show her the gift she'd made for me, but how could I face my family wearing such awful garb? I steeled myself and headed back down the stairs, the ties swishing, the black silk peeking through with every step. I shuffled into the family room like I was walking the plank, not the runway. I saw Roger slap his hand over his mouth, trying not to lose it. Lindsay seemed to be intently studying the wallpaper. Uncle June pointed at me and said, "That has got to be the ugliest skirt I've ever seen." The whole room erupted into laughter. I froze watching Aunt Frieda. Her hands covered her face and her shoulders were shaking. She must be devastated that everyone was making fun of the mementos of her late husband. "Aunt Frieda, it means so much to me that you would give me Uncle Charles' ties," I said. As she lifted her hands from her face, I could see the tears in her eyes. I felt terrible for her, but then Aunt Frieda let out a hoot and burst out laughing harder than anyone else in the room. "Go take that hideous thing off," she sputtered. I was so relieved, I practically ran to hug her. "It was a lovely gesture," I said, and I actually meant it. That awful skirt was the craziest gift I'd ever gotten, and it turned out to be one of the best. It brought my family together. They were no longer arguing about religion, politics, and world events. What had started out as a typical contentious Christmas had become something wonderful, something, dare I say, joyful. After the last guest had left, I shut our front door and leaned against it, exhausted. "Well, that went better than expected," Roger said. "But Mom," Lindsay said, "we forgot to draw names for next year." I stared at the melted snow on my hardwood floors. I said, "Maybe the Lord wants us to end our annual Christmas party tradition on a high note." For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access at any time on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Overcoming Grief, The Legend of Zelda. how learning to play a video game unexpectedly helped this mom in her grief journey, by Lori Durham, Brunswick, Georgia. 6 years, it had been 6 years since my son Russell died in a car fire. He was only 27. My grief was more manageable than it had been at 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. I had accepted that there would always be an empty spot in my heart. My husband, John, my daughter, Allison, and my work as high school English teacher gave meaning to my life. I'd even been able to find moments of joys again. Still, joy and grief can coexist, and the pain of missing my son never let up. I tried to keep busy, otherwise I got lost in my regrets. I'd scolded Russell so often for his love for video games and demanded that he focus on his schoolwork. Why hadn't I pushed him less and enjoyed our time together more? As a teacher, I loved learning, and as a parent, one of my greatest joys was discovering something new about my children as they grew into the people God meant for them to be. I would never experience that again with Russell. Summer was the hardest. During the school year, there was plenty to occupy me, but now on summer break, there were too many hours to fill, especially on weekdays. John was at work, Allison lived in Florida with her husband, I was home alone, and I didn't know what to do with myself. I was at such loose ends that I watched John play a video game to unwind after work. He connected his Nintendo Switch console to our living room TV to play on the big screen. He was partway through The Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild, which Allison had convinced me we needed to get him for Christmas. John and Russell had been the gamers in our family. They'd played all kinds of video games together. I'd tuned out, mentally working on lesson plans. My only conversations with Russell about video games had consisted of me telling him, "Turn off that silly game and finish your homework. Read a book. That's how you'll expand your mind." He'd roll his eyes and say, "You just don't get it, Mom." So I was surprised to find myself following along as John directed the game's main character, a young knight named Link, on his quest. "What's Link's objective?" I asked. "He has to protect Princess Zelda and save the kingdom of Hyrule," John said, moving Link up a tree. "How does picking a weird spiky fruit help with that?" "This is the hardy durium," John said. "It extends his life in battle." He explained that gathering ingredients and cooking them were a key part of the gameplay. "The meals and elixirs give Link a boost," John said. "Some increase strength and stamina. Others protected him from cold, heat, or lightning, made him run faster, gave him stealth to sneak up on monsters." John said that at the start of Breath of the Wild, Link had been awakened from a 100-year slumber. Now he had to regain his memory, strength, and skills to help Zelda face the forces of evil that were to destroy Hyrule. It sounded as if Link was on a hero's journey, a narrative archetype I recognized from literature. The world building in this game was intense, along the lines of Shakespeare and Tolkien. Despite myself, I was impressed, and I got interested in the story, enough that after several nights of watching John play, I was growing impatient with how long it was taking him to advance in the game, mainly because it took so much time to collect food. "Why don't you let me gather ingredients tomorrow while you're at work?" I asked one June evening. "Then you can concentrate on the storyline." "Really?" John said. "It'll give me something to do." A look of understanding crossed John's face. He taught me how to use the controller to maneuver Link across the landscapes of Hyrule. "This button controls his master sword. This is his bow," John said, "but you probably won't need to fight monsters if you're just looking for food." I had no desire to fight monsters. Yet there I was the next morning, staring in horror at the TV screen, as a lit Lionel, part lion, part man, part horse, towered over Link. I'd been doing okay, having Link explore a forest, pick mushrooms, find acorns. The next thing I knew, he was up against the beast, wielding a savage crusher. "What did John say about the Master Sword?" I had no clue, but I couldn't get Link killed. I did the only thing I could think of. I turned Link around and ran away. I saved my progress and shut off the game. "How'd you do?" John asked when he got home. "Awful. A Lyle attacked. I got scared and ran away." "I haven't been able to kill one of those either," he said. "I would have done the same, so don't feel bad." He chuckled. "Russell would have gotten a kick out of seeing you do battle with a Lionel. He'd have hung in there." Russell had such a competitive spirit. He played to win no matter the game. Even Dance Dance Revolution, he'd have us all laughing as he threw himself into outdancing his much younger sister. Then he'd collapse on the couch, arms raised in victory. "Let's look for smaller monsters," John said, turning the game on. "I'll show you how to defend yourself." I watched closely as he chose weapons for Link to obliterate less intimidating monsters. Then John handed me the controller. "Your turn." I confronted a little monster that looked like a blob of blue jello. "Step to the left," John coached. "Swing the sword in a smaller arc. You've got it." After a few tries, I dispatched the monster. "That was cool," I said. "Russell would be proud," John said. "You know, The Legend of Zelda was one of his favorites." "I didn't know," I said with a sigh. I was too busy telling him to turn off his games to pay attention to what he was playing. John wrapped his arms around me. "Russell knew you loved him. I could only think of the missed opportunities to bond with my son. That's why I kept playing Breath of Wild while John was at work. If I did something Russell loved, maybe he wouldn't feel so far away or my grief so close." As the summer went on, I defeated monsters, solved puzzles, completed side quests, talked strategy with John. I liked how there were multiple ways to overcome each challenge. Link didn't have to climb a mountain. He could hike around it. I got immersed in the story of the Kingdom of Hyrule, the underlying mythology of the Zelda series. I was playing one afternoon when Link and Zelda encountered her father. The king was furious Zelda had been spending time with scientists investigating ancient machines. She was supposed to be obtaining mystical powers that had been foretold would save the world. "You have responsibilities to your kingdom," the king bellowed. "When will you stop treating this as some sort of childish game? You're wasting your time, Zelda." I flinched, hearing my own words to Russell, pushing him to focus on academics. Zelda had such curiosity about the world around her. She was observant, a quick study. Had I overlooked these same traits in my son? Once I chaperoned a trip he took to Italy with his high school Latin class. In Florence, the kids discovered an amazing gelato shop, but only Russell could memorize the circuitous route from our hotel. Every night, an hour before lights out, he led his friends through a maze of medieval streets to get gelato. A hero's journey. Zelda wasn't the only one with a parent who couldn't see past their own nose. "I'm so sorry, Russell," I whispered. "You weren't wasting time playing video games. You were using critical thinking, sharpening your skills through a creative application of them." After that, I'd talk to Russell whenever I got stuck in a game. When I couldn't master a skill, when an enemy threatened Link, I'd been avoiding battling the dreaded Lionel, but my luck ran out when Link needed arrows to complete a quest. A Lionel had arrows. "We're going to have to fight this guy after all," I said. I hiked Link through a thick pine forest until I spied a Lionel. I armed Link with his best weapons and fed him a variety of elixirs. No one was running away today. Link strode toward the Lionel. It was fierce, but I wasn't scared. I recalled everything I'd learned fighting smaller monsters. Thrust, parry, dodge. The Lionel was stunned. Link jumped on its back and with a mighty swing of his sword, vanquished the monster. I leapt up from the couch, screaming with joy. I waved my arms, doing a little victory dance. "I get it now," I shouted, partly to Russell and partly to God. Only God could have known how this game would connect me with my son in a whole new way and give me insights into him that I never expected. Link's journey was a lot like my grief journey, full of challenges and setbacks, milestones and victories, and even a few monsters. Like the hero of Hyrule, I was finding my own path. For more on this story, see Family Room. Now a story from Guideposts 2022, The Joys of Christmas. The Joy of Giving, The Giving Trees. Each vintage ornament is like a little page from a scrapbook of Christmas's past, by Bob Richter, Lambertville, New Jersey. I grew up going to flea markets and auctions with my dad and yard sales and thrift shops with my older brother, Johnny. During one day's outing with my dad, he handed me a box of charming old ornaments, a blue jay, a Santa Claus, bells, ice cream cone. It's time you started collecting something, he said, and I know you like Christmas. That's how my love for the vintage Christmas lifestyle got started. Maybe you've seen me on PBS's Market Warriors or other shows sharing advice about bargaining, design, and antiques galore, but vintage Christmas decorations are still my favorite thing to discuss. Today, that original box has grown into a collection of thousands of ornaments, lights, and decorations. I can't wait to bring them out every year. In my living room, I have a 9-foot balsam fir, my evergreen lady, where I hang many of those ornaments Dad gave me more than 3 decades ago. But that's just one of my trees. I'm a big believer in having a tree in every room, and I decorate about 20 a year. Many are tabletop size, some artificial, some live, and easy to tuck into corners. Joy at every turn. I always begin decorating right after Thanksgiving. If I can wait till then. As I unwrap each treasure, memories flood in. Ornaments made of glass and metal, plastic and paper, handmade and factory made, from the 1800s to a few decades old. I remember where I got the piece and from whom, like the time my German grandmother handed me down to me Father Christmas ornament she bought in the 1930s, or the antique collector who put aside some pieces he knew I'd appreciate. While I decorate each tree for my own pleasure, I find a true Christmas spirit in sharing my trees with family and friends. Nearly everyone says something like, "My grandmother had one of these," or "These remind me of my aunt." The ornaments call up memories we all have in common. A tall, thin white tree with white lights sits on a mahogany demulene table in my foyer, a warm welcome for folks coming in from the cold. The balsam is in the next room over, where I also keep my Hollywood tree, so named because it has a bit of the glamour of the late 30s and early 40s, with its hand-painted silver ornaments dazzling against the tree's white branches. I put 2 tabletop trees in the dining room, one on the buffet and another on the main table. For the bedroom, I like a serene tabletop tree. Then I lean toward a selection of Victoria paper scrap ornaments, which are typically illustrations of children or angels affixed to wreaths of early tinsel or wire. Or I use the only pine cones, something that has a charming vibe for a good night's sleep. I go all out in my guest room display. I decorate a small tabletop table with white lights and glass balls. Under it, I place a 1950s light-up Santa given to me by my brother Johnny. As I put it all together, it feels as if I'm channeling his kindness. One December afternoon, when my mom brought me home from a checkup, I was delighted to find a little tree Johnny had set up in my room. I want my guests to feel as cared for as I did when they see a tree set up just for them. I think a tree in the kitchen is warm and welcoming, if a bit unexpected. My tree sits in the center of the island and has become a focal point for elaborate holiday vignettes. Last year, I adorned it with knee-hugger elves and spinner ornaments that twirled from the heat of old-fashioned lighted ice balls. Snowman and Santa Claus blow molds of hollow hard plastic, popular from the 1940s to the 1970s, flanked either side. Cheery company for my morning coffee. In the bathroom, I keep a few vintage bottle brush trees, ever so slightly kitschy, sturdy and easy to put up and take down. Plastic ornaments were holed up well against steam from the shower. I also have a multicolored bottle brush tree featuring a foiled rosette with small mercury glass balls and American flags. If you look closely, ornaments are really a snapshot of history. I have star ornaments from the 1950s that remind me of women's jewelry popular in those days. I hang the stars on a mirror in my hallway for some extra sparkle, and I'm always on the lookout for unsilvered ornaments from the mid-1940s. At the start of World War II, precious resources were rationed. Many American ornament makers ceased adding the inner silver lining and used paper hangers and caps instead of the metal ones. One of my dearest from back then is a simple pink ball with a thin string attached to the top. It reminds me that people made do with what they had. In fact, my guess is that in those times, people needed Christmas more than ever. I have special places near my trees for other vintage Christmas pieces. A chalkware set of the Holy Family from the 1950s resides on the living room coffee table. A porcelain baby Jesus found at a flea market spends each Christmas front and center on my dining room table. Glittered cardboard staples stand freely and hang on the tree. Past meets present in my vintage Christmases with cherished friends and families. But whether a house has one tree or many, what matters is the sentiment behind it all. A house with a Christmas tree, decorated simply or lavishly, just feels like home. One filled to the rafters with joy from every ornament and every bough. Another story from Guidepost The Joys of Christmas 2022 is Past the Trail Mix. The holiday flight was jam-packed. I only wanted to block everyone out. By Kimberly Elkins, editor. I paced the crowded airport lounge, hot and sweaty and annoyed. It was 2 days before Christmas, and my flight from New York to my family in Virginia had been canceled at the last minute. Now the flight was delayed. What a rotten start to the holidays. There was no upside to being trapped among a bunch of total strangers. We boarded finally at a snail's pace. I batted my way down the aisle, only to discover that I was stuck in the middle seat instead of the window seat I'd booked. It was impossible to get comfortable, crammed in like a sardine, and we sat on the tarmac for an hour before being cleared for takeoff. I'd be lucky to get home before everyone was in bed. Considering my cranky mood, maybe that was for the best. I closed my eyes to collect myself. A baby somewhere behind me started bawling. I sighed and brought out my book. The red-haired woman in the coveted window seat noisily rummaged for something in her purse, trail mix. The bag crackled as she twisted and tugged to open it, her elbow jabbing mine. I couldn't hide my exasperation. "Do you want me to try?" I asked. She plunked the bag into my hands. I got a good grip on it and put all my frustrations into wrestling with the bag. The guy on the other side of me leaned into the aisle to stay out of my way until I gave up. "Here, let me have it," he said. His strategy involved lots of yanking, but got nowhere. The woman across the aisle offered to give it a shot. Her technique includes shaking the bag, which didn't help. The teenage boy beside her reached for the snack. "I can do it," he said confidently. But nope, the muscled fellow in that row's window seat took a turn. "How could this little bag of trail mix defeat the six of us?" "I've got an idea," the teenager said to the man. "You take one side and I'll take the other." I craned my neck to watch. Together they pulled, and ta-da, we'd done it. The bag was on its way back to the owner when she said, "No, I want everyone to have some." So back down the row, far row it went, with each person pouring out a few nuts and raisins, then across the aisle again to my row. I shook out a bit and then handed it to the woman. When she turned it upside down, only a single peanut rolled out. She laughed and held up the empty bag. "Merry Christmas. God bless us, everyone." On a trip where everything had gone wrong, six strangers had given each other some Christmas cheer in a most unexpected way. I hoped my family would still be awake for me to bring it home to them. That's all the time we have for Guidepost today. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.